you can have the best product in the world and, you know, it's 20 times better than anything else. But if you don't communicate that to people and they don't understand it, then you might as well not have bothered.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok.
My guest today is Michael Solomon. Here's three facts I think you should know about Michael. One, at the age of 14, he started working as a salesman in a store, formal wear store, selling tuxedos. Two, his parents were lifelong Democrats. So you can imagine the humor they saw when they volunteered to work as at the after the 1990 presidential election. Michael, his mom, and his dad were working at the coat check stand at Ronald Reagan's inaugural ball at the Kennedy Center, where they enjoyed hanging up the fur coats of many celebrities and politicians. And three, over 1 million students have enjoyed and have learned from using his books on marketing and consumer behavior that he's been writing for many years. Michael Solomon, welcome to Your Intended Message.
Hi, George. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Michael, you have, now I'm curious, when you were hanging up the coats, did you find some nice car keys in the pockets?
Well, that's classified information, I'm afraid.
Over 1 million students have used your marketing books, and your marketing, you focus on the behavior, how people behave from the signals they get from sellers. Is that a fair statement?
That's certainly part of it. I mean, the way I got into all of this I'm trained as a social psychologist. And I was very interested in how we decide how we feel about not only ourselves, but also others. And a lot of that has to do with, obviously, the things we buy, the things we display, the things we want people to know about us. So you focus a lot on communication. Obviously, some of that is verbal and some of that is nonverbal. So I guess you could maybe lump me more on the nonverbal side.
One of your articles talked about the relevance of wearables, the growing market for wearables. And at one time, a wearable technology was a watch. And at one time, I remember when you actually had to wind it to make it run. And then we got all excited when it came out with these new digital ones that were red numbers on the watch. But now that market seems to be growing. Do you see that exploding even more, the whole wearable market?
Well, that's, you know, there's a big question mark there. A lot of people do expect it to explode, but so far it's not quite living up to expectations. And part of that, I think, is that consumers don't really know what to think about these products. You know, it's it's really what we call a hybrid product because it's marrying together elements of luxury, you know, like an expensive watch, for example, and technology. And so to some extent, it replicates other things that we use to get information, you know, like our heartbeat and so on. And so there's still some confusion about how people categorize it. You know, our brains like to put things into neat categories. And when you've got something like a computer that you're wearing on your wrist, I think the industry hasn't quite caught up to that and doesn't quite know how to explain to consumers why they should use these products as opposed to the more traditional ones that you were talking about. And keep in mind that wearables embrace a lot more than just a watch on your wrist. I mean, at this point, there are so many different technological devices that we can literally wear or ingest that become part of our bodies. You know, like, for example, contact lenses for diabetics that can actually monitor sugar levels in their bloodstream just by, you know, having that device in their eye. So there's a lot of really interesting futuristic things that are coming out. But as we know in marketing, you know, you can have the best product in the world and, you know, it's 20 times better than anything else. But if you don't communicate that to people and they don't understand it, then you might as well not have bothered.
Now, it almost sounds like the wearables market, if it's going to thrive, it needs someone like a Steve Jobs, who, for example, when he was selling the iPod, he came out and he simply said, "I have 1,000 songs in my pocket."
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, and you know what he understood at some level was that. What I like to say is we don't buy things because of what they do. We buy things because of what they mean. And so a lot of people in marketing communications don't seem to understand that that they're selling attributes of a product, but consumers are not buying attributes of a product. They're buying the benefits of the product. And so when he said that he has that music that he can carry around, he's focusing correctly on that benefit. And so that's a, you know, it's a basic distinction. It should be marketing 101. I teach it to my students all the time, but it's easy to lose sight of that when you start focusing on all the great things your product or service does rather than the benefits that we get when we use it.
Now, I see an interesting analogy because I've talked with other guests, for example, who have approached the conversation of the self-introduction at the networking event. And people, when they introduce themselves, they typically talk about what they do, but not the benefit from what they do. And that sounds like that's what marketers are falling into that habit.
Yeah, that's a great insight. And, you know, we know that people are brands and this whole personal branding movement, you know, has grown legs, I guess, in the last decade or so. But we teach our students that all the time. You know, you are a brand and you've got to follow the same basic rules of marketing, you know, the famous 4 P's and the marketing mix in order to promote yourself the way you want people to see you. And again, that's like you say, you know, I think that's an interesting comparison. You don't come in giving your attributes. You want to show people why it's worthwhile to them to get to know you.
You talked about that we buy what products mean, not necessarily what they do. Can you give us an example, an insight of now naturally there are some products that naturally, you know, it's obvious. It could be clothing, fashion, for example. We buy because it makes us feel good. We, whether it's a jacket, running shoes, a watch, but we buy them because of how they make us feel and perhaps because we want to show it off. But what about other products that don't intuitively fall into that category? Can you give us an example of one or two?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, any consumer-facing product pretty much does what you described. You know, clothing is the obvious one. That's where I started my own research program years ago, working with companies like Levi Strauss to understand how a simple pair of blue jeans is actually not so simple. But, you know, any really consumer-facing product, you know, classic example would be a car, right? So a car, obviously, you know, the main benefit that it provides is transportation from point A to point B, but that's not why we buy a car. You know, I mean, that's certainly something we want to get out of the purchase, hopefully, but there are so many other ways that we consume a car, if you will, that have to do with psychological benefits, even if it's just, you know, impressing your girlfriend, whatever it is. If you look at automotive advertising, really very little of it has to do with transportation. And so that's a prime example of what I'm talking about. But you can look in any category, home furnishings, cosmetics, fragrances, footwear, business accessories, financial services, really just about anything. And by the way, in the B2B space as well, you know, we like to think that B2B, business-to-business purchases are very rational, and we're not affected by the same biases. And, you know, I beg to differ, because so much of B2B purchases are, quote, irrational. You know, we may have, let's say, a favorite salesperson that we've worked with for 20 years. And so we're gonna buy whatever he or she suggests. You know, it has very little to do with the product and a lot to do with our relationship with that salesperson.
Rational versus irrational. So if people buy based on irrational reasons, how can any marketer have a hope of figuring out the irrationality of people?
Well, just because they seem irrational doesn't, you know, they're still very, very important, and they're more central to who we are than the so-called rational reasons we buy things. Because so many brands and products are really central, literally, to our identities. And so marketers can still understand that once they broaden their focus, and many of them get this, but not all of them do. Again, moving from, I guess you'd say, from an attributes to a benefits kind of perspective, it just so happens that many of those benefits are what economists or a traditional economist might call irrational, yet they're still incredibly important. So it's just a matter of doing the right kind of research, frankly, to get at that. You know, and a lot of traditional marketing research tools do not get at these underlying reasons. You know, if you send out a survey to 1,000 people and they're answering on scales, you know, from not at all satisfied to extremely satisfied, that's nice to know, but it gets at the what, but not at the why. So the answer to your question, in a sense, is moving away from the what to the why by doing, for example, qualitative consumer research, where you're really able to get into the weeds with people and understand the actual motivations, if they can articulate them. And by the way, they often can't articulate the real reason they buy something, or they're not willing to. So you do have to get a little creative sometimes, that's for sure.
Now, going back to the car conversation, I recall the last time I bought a new car, and I was all ready to sign the contract and move on. And that's when you sit in the room and the person tries to sell you additional options. And I'm sitting there thinking, nope, don't want that. Don't want that. Don't want that. And then the person said, do you want to have the windows tinted? And my first response was, nah, I don't need tinted windows. And then the person said, it'll make you look cool. I got tinted windows.
There you go. Did it work?
It did. Yeah. It was a split second decision.
Yeah.
Look
and
cool.
Now and now you're cool. There you go. That was easy. Cool.
And so, yes, it was a totally irrational decision on my part, and I don't regret it. I like those tinted windows. Yeah. So now, and I also wonder, instead of the word rational, could we substitute the word emotional and convey the same meaning?
Certainly come close. I mean, we know that people do buy, many of the things that we buy are based on an initial emotional reaction. And then what we do is we fill in the blanks after that. That's where our cognitive functions come in, where we say, where we start to fill in the so-called objective reasons why we felt so good when we, you know, were offered those tinted windows. So it's kind of an after the fact rationalization very often, because emotional responses are much more primal. They're the more primitive parts of our brains that actually evolved from reptiles, you know, a long time ago. That's the primary way that we approach products. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that it's irrational, because after all, if we buy something in order to feel good and it makes us feel good, that is a very, in a way, a very rational response. It's just, it's not a functional response. It's more, it's not objective, it's subjective, if you will.
Now, during times of crisis, like during the pandemic, emotions tend to be more unpredictable, fluctuating greatly. Therefore, does that make it more difficult for marketers to reach their market, or is there some way they can take advantage of those emotions?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. It's one I get asked a lot. You know, what does consumer behavior look like in this new normal, so to speak? And it does create challenges. It does create opportunities. Let me first focus on that. One of the things that a crisis like this does is it kind of unfreezes consumers. You know, generally speaking, people like to have a routine. They like to have habits. They like to have predictability. And that's why new brands often find it very hard to break in when there's an established leader that's been there a long time, because people do have these strong emotional connections, et cetera. But what happens in a situation like this is that suddenly our basic day-to-day is disrupted, literally disrupted, you know. And what that means is that we suddenly have to be open to alternative ways to do things. You know, an example would be a lot of people before the pandemic would never consider doing their grocery shopping online and having it delivered. And now we see more and more people doing that because they were forced to do it. You know, some of those people, when everybody's well again, some of those people will be happy to go back to the supermarket and get jostled by the grocery carts and the other shoppers, et cetera. But some proportion of those people will stick with that online shopping. And so what that means is that they were open to a change in behavior, and now they're going to refreeze into that new configuration. So if you're a startup brand, if you have a solution that is not the mainstream solution, this is a very good window to get into that. But having said that, to answer the other part of your question, you know, as I mentioned, what we're lacking is stability in our lives and predictability, because every day is literally a different scenario. You know, can we eat in restaurants? Can we hug people? And on and on. And so what you see is that brands that can successfully convey the story of reassurance, that they're working with you, that they're helping, they're giving back to the community, et cetera, they are going to do very well. So for example, sales of comfort foods, you know, like those, you know, pastas in a can and things like that, you know, meatloaf, that those sorts of foods that we call comfort foods, those sales have gone through the roof since last March, because people are craving that kind of familiarity and reassurance and stability.
If people are craving familiarity during the crisis, post-crisis, will they tend to be more willing to try new things?
I think they're going to be more willing to do the things they were doing before, and double down on that. You know, there's going to be a lot of kind of revenge spending and binging and all of that as we finally get back into the world. But, you know, one scenario is that consumers are going to remember who really stepped up to the plate during the crisis and who really which companies did a good job of the things I was talking about, you know, showing not just talking the talk, but really walking the walk in terms of making promises about how they're supporting their workers and how they're supporting the environment, et cetera, living up to those promises. People are going to remember that, I think, and continue to reward those companies for not turning tail and running during the crisis.
Does that mean that during the crisis, the marketers perhaps should focus less on the product and more on the relationship?
The relationship is paramount. That's what people are looking for. And they want brands to help with this whole situation. In fact, you know, in some surveys show that consumers believe that brands can do more to make our lives better than governments can. Now, that doesn't mean they love brands. It's really an indictment of what governments are not doing, right? But they're, what they're seeing is that you have some brands, maybe we can call them activist brands, that are really taking what is frankly a risky step, you know, in terms of, let's say, racial injustice or environmental issues and so on. And those brands have largely been rewarded. You know, they've lost some people, like Nike, for example. Initially, when Nike came out in favor of, you know, kneeling in the U.S. during the before a football game, the initial reaction was a lot of people didn't like that and they gave up on Nike. But in the long run, Nike actually gained more customers, I believe, than they lost, because they took a stand and people appreciated that.
Now, it's when one takes a stand on anything at any time, the danger is that some people won't like it. Some people won't like you. Some customers might complain. And so how does a brand know, a company, a product, how do they know how much opposition is productive, is profitable?
Well, the ideal answer is they don't care, because they're going to take the stand because they believe in it. Now, having said that, they have to satisfy their shareholders and so on. So that's not always possible. But by definition, you know, any time we create a definition of our target market, what we're saying is we can't have everybody in our franchise, you know, and maybe Walmart, somebody like that. But really, modern marketing is built on the idea of acknowledging that you can't be all things to all people. And what you want to do, you know, it's very tempting. Everybody wants to go out and add new customers. But what they forget is that their existing customers who are really loyal to them are far more valuable. And so, you know, as I always tell my students, it's much more expensive to attract a new customer than it is to keep an old one. And so, you know, we talk about the so-called 80-20 rule. And in marketing, what that means is that, as a rule of thumb, 80% of your revenues come from 20% of your customers. Now, that's not always set in stone, that ratio, but it's a reminder that your heavy users are buying a lot more of your product. So, if they are on board with what you're doing, they're going to support you and probably advocate for you. And yes, maybe you're going to lose some of those people on the perimeter, but they weren't really your good customers to begin with. So, if you want to double down on a cause and it syncs with your values, you know, if you're a Patagonia and you already have a history of making products that are environmentally friendly, then you can be pretty sure that you have a very loyal customer base, and they're going to eat it up when you do more and more of that. So yeah, you're going to lose some customers who, you know, maybe are going to buy a coat from you once every 10 years, but you're not going to lose the customers who are in your store or on your website once a week.
Michael, you have a new book just launched. And for those who are watching the video, the image is behind you there. It's called The New Chameleons: How to Connect with Consumers Who Defy Categorization. And I always like to think that that's me, because I don't like anybody sticking me in a category. But tell us, why is that relevant now?
Well, it's especially relevant, first of all, because you are not at all unusual in this sense. Almost anybody doesn't like to be stuck into a category or given a label. The problem is that for many years, that's exactly what we've done. And mea culpa, we teach our next generation of marketing students the same thing, that if we put someone into a broad category, say a demographic category like women in their 20s, somehow we've understood them and we can expect all women in their 20s to be similar when it comes to their preferences. Now, if I talk to any woman in their 20s, and my students, you know, I do this all the time, they always tell me, well, I'm not like anybody else. Now, there are certainly some commonalities, But in today's environment, we're more like what we call markets of one, where each of us is moving much more rapidly among different lifestyle segments. We're experiencing new things. And so I call the book The New Chameleons, because what we see people doing today is like the chameleon that changes colors in response to its environment. And actually, I've learned its mood. So when they feel good or bad, their color actually changes. We are a lot like that, in that each of us is changing our identities very quickly, and we're able to try on new things, even if it's just a matter of being exposed, let's say, to different kinds of foods or different kinds of music or clothing that we see other people using online, or when we go into Zoom meetings, now we can see what their living room looks like. You know, what that does is it opens people up, and it makes them want to experience a lot of other realities as well. And so in the old days, when we had, when we had basically broadcasting versus narrowcasting, we had maybe three or four big TV networks that everybody watched, then it made more sense to put people into these broad categories. But in a narrow casting world, where each of us is able to curate our own experience to such a great degree, and marketers are able to serve us up the images and the information that we want to see, that we're telling them that we want to see, those tried and true principles where we put people into these categories no longer make sense. And so, in the book, I talk about some of these basic dichotomies that we love to use that don't make sense anymore. For example, male versus female, it doesn't get more basic than that. But when you talk to a lot of people today, you understand that, especially younger people, they don't see the world that way. They don't see you as being either male or female. Many people are identifying with something in the middle, or maybe some mixture that we're not familiar with. And that's just one of many categories that I talk about. And so when marketers understand that they have to throw away those old assumptions, it's really positive. It's negative because it requires us to work a lot harder to understand each individual customer, but it also opens up enormous opportunities. So for example, with the male, with the gender issue, you got a lot of men around the world, males around the world, who are much more interested in products that used to be sold exclusively to women, like man bags and jewelry and even cosmetics for men. So that's just one isolated example where suddenly, let's say if you're a cosmetics manufacturer, you never thought about selling to men, and half of the world's population is not buying your product, where now maybe some of them are. So by looking, not putting people in boxes, but looking between the boxes and thinking about products that combine, like I was talking about before with wearables, when you were asking about that, a wearable is a hybrid category that can't be easily categorized. Yet people will be receptive to that if you show them the reasons why.
Now, I suppose when it comes to labels, perhaps one of the A label that's been overused and is the group called millennials. People come out and say, "Here's what you need to know about millennials."
Right.
And we can't use that broad brush on that whole age group.
No, I mean it's a helpful start. Don't get me wrong. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, all things equal, 20-year-olds and 80-year-olds are different. So I'm certainly not saying that. But when you look within a broad category, like that's a good example of a demographic category, by the way, which is so large that some demographers talk about two sub parts of that, what they call Y.1 and Y.2, based on when people were born. But whether it's Generation X or, again, these labels we love to give, baby boomers and so on, number one, there are huge differences among those people. And number two, the definition of what constitutes, let's say, a baby boomer or a millennial, the things that they buy, et cetera, changes because our lives are constantly in flux. And so we talk, today we like to say 80 is the new 60 or 60 is the new 40. And so there are many counterexamples where, for example, you know, older people like me actually have tastes and preferences that are a lot more similar to my kids or even my grandkids sometimes, you know, than we would think. And so, sure, it's a fine starting point to talk about a big group like that. But, you know, when I say to my students, I say, okay, you're all, well, now they're all Gen Y. Excuse me, they're all alphas, Gen Zs. And I say to them, so you're all Gen Zs, that means you're all identical, right? And you can imagine the kind of looks I get.
As consumer shopping moves forward beyond the pandemic, consider these three influences on shopping. One is online buying, two is automation, and three is the use of AI, of artificial intelligence. How do you see those forces changing, shaping the way we shop post-pandemic?
Yeah, I talk and write quite a bit about this because it's definitely a huge change that we're going to see. And again, the pandemic has not created these changes. What it's done is to accelerate changes that were already happening. For example, the acceptance of automation in retail. So there's a lot of interesting issues there. You know, we definitely can't get into all of them, but for example, as people are going to become increasingly going to be interacting with non-human salespeople, we have to start to think about that. We have to start to think about what it means to interact with a robot. Now, a robot doesn't catch a virus. It catches a different kind of virus, not, you know, a software virus, not our kind of virus. So we're going to see more and more of this stuff. And it's, you talk about an explosion, the number of household robots that are going to be coming online in the next few years is in the millions and millions. So there's a lot of questions that retailers and marketers need to grapple with, because you can't just take a customer who is used to interacting with a flesh and blood person for all the good and bad, because often those interactions are negative, but we can't just take that person away and now have a robot or a chatbot in its place and expect that people are going to continue with the same kind of interaction. So there's a whole room full of questions that you're opening with that one question that have to do with how we create an AI experience that is going to simulate the human experience, or ethically if we want to do that. So already what we're seeing, and some research is showing, is that when in some cases, the AI is getting so good that when people are interacting, let's say in a call center, when they're talking to someone, they're not necessarily sure if it's a human being on the other end of the phone. They really can't tell, because already the data scientists and the designers, the engineers, are starting to mimic human speech. So that when a teenager, you know, interacts with a shop bot for, let's say, H&M, what they're going to see on their phone is the computer's going to use words like awesome. And I wish I had a nickel for every time my students said the word awesome. They deliberately are going to program the chat bot to use words like that in order to create this sense of camaraderie, if you will. And so definitely the shopping experience is going to change. I think it's going to be more of a discretionary kind of thing where we don't just automatically go out shopping for everything we need, because we're going to order that stuff. The shopping experience will be, first of all, will be a social class difference, where I think more affluent people will be able to afford to, let's say, book an appointment with a stylist at Nordstrom, rather than just walking into Nordstrom and browsing around. So it's going to be a different kind of experience. It's going to be a more curated experience that has a lot more to do with stimulation, recreation, education, whereas the routine daily stuff, that's going to show up when the guy from UPS knocks on your door.
Stimulation, recreation, education. Significant words to wrap up on. My guest today is Michael Sullivan. Solomon, like the king. And Michael leaves us with the message: we buy, what we buy, what the brand means to us. We don't buy the product, but we buy because it connects with us.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.